Tonight's speaker is Professor Scott Tremaine from Princeton University. Professor Tremaine received his BSc from McMaster University and then moved on to a PhD at Princeton. After that, he took up a professorship at Massachusetts Institute for Technology, otherwise known for people who can speak better as MIT. Then he went on to take up the founding directorship of CETA, the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics at Toronto, and was a professor of physics and astronomy at University of Toronto, whereupon he moved back to Princeton following a long stint as the director of CETA. Professor Tremaine's research is mostly directed towards a better understanding of dynamics in astrophysical systems. He has studied planetary rings, planetary systems, galaxies, and clusters of galaxies. Professor Tremaine has received the Dirk Brouwer Award in 1997 for his outstanding contributions to galactic dynamics and solar system dynamics. Professor Tremaine is currently working on his second edition of his landmark book, Galactic Dynamics, which he wrote with Professor James Binney. And Professor Tremaine is also a founding member of the Perimeter Institute Scientific Advisory Committee and has spent countless hours towards its formation and development, for which we thank him very much. This evening's lecture will be on the stability of the solar system. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Scott Tremaine.
The understanding of the geometry and the dynamics of the solar system in which we live was one of the most successful and most important intellectual accomplishments of the last millennium. For thousands of years, as civilization developed, humans believed that the Earth was flat and sat at the center of the universe, and that the sun and the stars and the other planets revolved around it. And even after recognizing that the Earth was a sphere rather than being flat, they still continued to believe that the sun and the planets revolved around it. And the recognition that this was in fact not correct and that the geometry of the solar system was quite different from what everyone had believed for many, many years was really due to three figures. The first of these was Nicholas Copernicus, who made the first persuasive case that the Earth was not at the center of the solar system. That in fact, the sun was at the center. Venus and Mercury orbited inside the Earth. The Earth was the third planet from the center. The moon revolved around it. And then the other planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, were in turn outside it. And the really important part of Copernicus's insight and why this is sometimes called the Copernican Revolution was not so much that the sun was at the center of the solar system, but that he deposed the Earth from its primary position as being the center of everything in the universe. And that recognition was so important and has turned out to be such a useful guiding principle in astronomy in the last 400 years that it's been elevated to the status of a principle called the Copernican principle, which says that we're not located at a special place in the universe or at a special time in the history of the universe. So for example, the Earth revolves around the sun. The sun is only one of something like 10 billion stars. The sun is an ordinary, middle-aged, unremarkable star, one of these 10 billion stars that orbits the Milky Way galaxy. And in turn, the Milky Way is an average-sized galaxy, one of something like 100 billion galaxies throughout the universe as a whole. The second great figure in understanding the solar system was Johannes Kepler. Kepler studied historical data on the positions of the planets that had been gathered over many years. And he recognized that you could distill all of this data into three very simple empirical laws to describe the motion of the planets. One is that the orbit of a planet is an ellipse. That's particularly important because in many intellectuals, for example, the Greeks believed that things that went on in the heavens were perfect. The only perfect figure is a circle, and so the planets have to move in circles. And Kepler recognized that that was wrong, that the orbits were ellipses, and in particular that the sun is not at the center of the ellipse, but it's at one of the geometrical points called the focus of the ellipse. He also recognized that planets don't move around the sun at uniform speed. They go faster when they're closer to the sun, so that if you had an imaginary line joining the planet and the sun, it would sweep out equal areas in equal times. And third, he recognized that there was a relation between the orbital period, the time it takes the planet to go around once, and the size of the planet's orbit. The square of the period was proportional to the cube of the distance. But these were empirical laws. They had no basis in physics. And that basis was only provided by Isaac Newton, who many people regard as the greatest physicist who ever lived. Newton formulated two of the most basic laws of physics that we use to this day, his law of motion, which says that force is mass times acceleration, and his law of gravity, which says that any two bodies attract one another with a gravitational force that's proportional to the product of their masses and the square of the distance between them. And this inverse square law of Newton's has been modified slightly by Einstein's general theory of relativity, but in almost all astronomical contexts, Newton's law is still accurate enough, and it's certainly accurate for anything we have to do with the solar system. And in addition to formulating these two laws, Newton then applied them to show that the empirical laws that Kepler had described could be entirely explained as mathematical consequences of the equations of motion determined by Newton's first two laws. Newton was a remarkable guy. Not only did he do this, but he did this in only part of his career. A large part of his later career he spent as Master of the Royal Mint. So it's particularly appropriate that for many years the £1 note in the United Kingdom had a picture of Newton on the opposite side from the picture of the Queen. However, this honor is a little ironic because you can see that the engraver who drew the beautiful picture of these elliptical orbits actually put the sun at the center rather than at one focus, which, of course, explaining why is that the focus was one of Newton's primary accomplishments, which just shows why you shouldn't go and work for the government, I guess. But Newton was not able to solve for the physics of the solar system completely. All he was able to do was to solve for the motion of one planet in the sun. But Newton's law of gravity says that every body attracts every other body, and that means that not only is the sun attracting the Earth in its orbit, but Jupiter is attracting it, Mars is attracting it, every planet attracts every other planet. And that means that the motion is more complicated than the motion of just one planet around the sun would be. Newton tried to solve this more complicated problem and failed. It was a reasonable approximation for him to ignore the other planets because the masses of the other planets are much smaller than the mass of the sun. But he always sort of wondered, well, if the solar system goes on for millennia into the future, for thousands or millions of years, there are all these tiny tugs, say, from Jupiter on the orbit of the Earth. And the question is, over millions and billions of orbits, do those tugs cancel each other out so that the orbit of the Earth stays the same? Or do they gradually add up so that they gradually change the orbit of the Earth and destroy the regularity of the solar system? Newton wasn't the only one who tried to solve this problem. Many of the best physicists and mathematicians over the next 300 years tried to solve the same problem. It's become dignified with the title of the gravitational n-body problem, which basically says if you have a single mass surrounded by some arbitrary number of much smaller masses on nearly circular orbits, is that configuration stable over very long times? That is, do the simple ellipses that Newton explained remain the same, or are they gradually destroyed by these very weak repeated gravitational forces between the planets? So this is, of course, formulated very generally, as mathematicians like to do, but for the solar system, the point mass is the sun, the number of planets is, number n is 9, the 9 planets, and by very long times, I mean about 10 billion orbits, and that's because, you know, the Earth goes around once a year, Mercury goes around 3 or 4 times a year, the solar system has been around for 4.5 billion years since it was formed, and it's going to last for another 7 billion years until the sun dies, turns into a red giant, and engulfs and evaporates all the inner planets. So we're dealing with trying to understand this problem over something like 10 billion orbits. Well, whenever you're trying to apply a well-formulated, precise mathematical problem to a real physical system like the solar system, you have to ask how accurate it is, and you have to ask what things you've left out. Well, we've left out a lot. There are lots of very small bodies in the solar system, particular asteroids and comets. The sun slowly loses mass, both because it's radiating energy and because there's a wind of material called the solar wind that flows out from the sun. The planets suffer a certain amount of drag because the solar wind interacts, say, with the Earth's magnetosphere. The solar system isn't completely isolated because it's embedded in the Milky Way galaxy, and there are tidal forces from the Milky Way. Many of the planets, including our own, have satellites like the moon, and Newton's law says that those exert some gravity on all the planets as well. We've left those out. There are small modifications from Einstein's theory of general relativity, and every now and then a passing star in the galaxy happens to come by the solar system, and the gravity from that passing star might have a change in the planetary orbits. But when you look at all of these effects, and all of the effects that anyone's been able to think of, either they're very small, typically at the level of a part per billion or a part per trillion, or there's something that you can easily calculate and make minor modifications in this simple problem to include. So in fact, the conclusion is that at the level of a part per billion, and probably much better, this very simple mathematical problem really is relevant to the solar system. And the solution to this mathematical problem is the solution that will tell us what the ultimate fate of the Earth and the Earth's orbit is going to be. And so, naturally, we'd kind of like to understand it. Although it's important from an intellectual point of view to understand this problem, I'd like to try to justify it a little more. That is, why do we care long after we're dead what the fate of the Earth is going to be? Well, first, I think most people in the audience would agree that it's something we'd like to know. But it's also relevant for a number of other problems in astronomy and other fields. We'd like to know why there are so few planets. Why are there 9 planets in the solar system rather than, say, 15 or 30 or 100? Is that just an accident of the way the system was formed? Or is there something special about the dynamics of the solar system that forces you to have so few planets? A similar question is, why are the regions between the planets so clean? We believe that the planets were formed from a disk of dust and gas that gradually accumulated into bigger and bigger particles, which eventually collided and formed the planets. But if you go and look for leftover particles, say between Earth and Venus, there have now been very deep surveys of the region between Earth and Venus, and there are no leftover particles, say a few kilometers across, that might have been left over. So somehow, whoever made the solar system cleaned up swept the floor after it was done to the level of a part per billion. And we'd like to understand why that's true. We'd like to know where comets and meteors come from. The comets that we see and the meteors and meteorites that collide with the Earth are on orbits that are very short-lived on solar system times, only a tiny fraction of the age of the solar system. There must be some source that they're coming from that's continually supplying them. We'd like to know what that is. Most models of the formation of the solar system say that the planets were formed in something like a million years, which sounds long but is less than 0.1% of the lifetime of the solar system. We'd like to understand if the solar system, when it was first formed, looked the same way it does now, or if it's gradually evolved since then, perhaps as a result of dynamical effects in the solar system. We'd like to understand what other planetary systems look like, what the constraints on other planetary systems would be, and whether they can be like our own. A more prosaic question is that we'd like to understand the geological time scale. For almost every aspect of geology, whether dating the dinosaurs or understanding ages of various ice ages, those ages are dated by drilling and bringing up cores of sediments. And of course, since you don't know the sedimentation rate or whether it's been uniform, you can't calibrate the age of a piece of sediment that you dig out that's 30 meters down one of these cores. But what they do know is that the ratio of some isotopes, for example, the ratio of two isotopes of oxygen, changes systematically and periodically in those cores. And that change in the isotopic ratio reflects changes in the amount of water on Earth that's tied up in ice caps, hence reflects changes in the temperature. And it's believed that these periodic variations in the temperature are due to periodic variations in the Earth's orbit, because that affects the amount of sunlight that the Earth receives. And so if we can understand the behavior of the Earth's orbit over the last 100 million years, we can actually have an astronomical clock that we can use to calibrate all of the geological record. And finally, this problem, although it's remained unsolved in the most general form for the last 300 years, has inspired an enormous amount of work and has kind of been the mother of all problems in the subjects that we now know as chaos theory and nonlinear dynamics. These subjects have turned out to be relevant to a unexpectedly wide variety of subjects, including the future of the stock market, the evolution of populations and extinctions. And one of the general issues that's come up in trying to understand nonlinear dynamics is what the behavior of these more general dynamical systems are over very long times. A very specific similar problem is trying to build large particle accelerators for high energy physics experiments where they have elementary particles that orbit millions or billions of times. And if we can understand this sort of basic problem, which was the original problem in the subject, then we hope that it will shed some light on many other dynamical systems that we've learned are similar in their sort of general structure to the solar system. Well, Newton was a very smart guy, and Newton thought about this problem, and it's interesting to ask what Newton thought. And this is a quote from one of his books, which says, blind fate could never have made all the planets move one in the same way. He's basically saying, you have to explain why all the planets are in nearly circular orbits going around the same way. Some inconsiderable irregularities accepted. He's just saying that the orbits are ellipses, they're not perfect circles. And then he says, which could have arisen from the mutual actions of the planets upon one another, and which will be apt to increase until the system wants a reformation. So Newton thought that these small tugs from Jupiter on Earth, from Mars on Venus, were actually going to accumulate. We're going to make the orbits more and more elliptical, more and more eccentric, until something went wrong. And Newton wanted to know, you know, and couldn't figure out why the solar system was still so nearly, the orbits were still so nearly circular when he believed that the mutual gravity was likely to eventually destroy the system. There was a very interesting article by a historian of science, Hopkins, who basically says that Newton was Newton was very religious and he was upset because the success of his laws of motion kind of banished God's role in keeping the planets going around the sun. You know, they were now going around by Newton's laws rather than because God was pushing them. But he was reassured because he saw careful planning on the part of God to ensure long-term stability. And that Newton actually believed that from time to time God had to intervene in the solar system, you know, kind of straighten things up. And as Hoskins put it, God had a regular servicing contract with the solar system. That every, you know, the mutual interactions would make things more and more irregular, and God would eventually, you know, fix things up. And Newton was reassured because it meant that there was a continuing role for God, who he had otherwise banished from the solar system. Newton was not the only person who thought about this. Laplace, who was one of the great calculators who worked out many of the details of Newton's model, pointed out that Newton's model, Newton's laws for the evolution of the solar system were so successful in explaining the positions and the motions of the planets, in predicting eclipses, predicting the recurrence of comets in modern times, sending spacecraft to other planets, that he pointed out that since these laws were so successful, if similar laws govern all of nature, then an intelligence that knew at a given instant all the forces and all of the momentary positions of everything would be able to comprehend everything that went on in the universe. That is, they would be able to predict everything that would happen in the future in the universe and work backwards and describe everything that happened in the past. And as he says, to it nothing would be uncertain. Both future and past would be present before its eyes. And this somewhat extreme point of view has had an enormous influence on philosophers and has led to a school of thought which is now called Laplacian determinism. It's only one of the many views about the relation between determinism and free will, but has been one of the most influential because it says that we have no free will at all. And so the solar system is not only a problem that's intrinsic for in its own merits, but it's had a really major effect on a broad range of intellectual thought. So let me just review the cast of characters so that we all are reminded of what the planets are. This is Mercury, of course, named after the Roman god of commerce and travel. Mercury is the closest planet to the sun, has the most extreme temperature ranges, range of 600 degrees centigrade between its hottest points and coldest points. It's unlike the Earth in that it has no plate tectonics, it has no volcanoes, it just has a quiescent, heavily cratered surface. This picture comes from Mariner 10, which visited Mercury 30 years ago, and remarkably, that's the only spacecraft that's ever visited Mercury. Nothing has gone back there since then. The second planet out is Venus, which is the sister planet of the Earth, almost the same size and mass. Venus is, these are again spacecraft pictures from Pioneer 10 and from Magellan. Venus is covered with a dense layer of clouds, so you can see almost nothing of the surface features in the visible. This much more detailed picture showing the surface features is actually taken from radar, side-scanning radar on a spacecraft that orbited the planet and for the first time gave a detailed look at the topography of Venus. Venus is covered with an extremely dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide, something like 100 times the density of the Earth's atmosphere. The clouds rain sulfuric acid instead of water. It's a very unpleasant environment. Its surface temperature is extremely high, something like 500 degrees centigrade. That's because of an extreme version of the greenhouse effect in which infrared radiation can't escape from the surface through the dense carbon dioxide layer. And of course, the really unpleasant nature of Venus's surface is an extreme view that people who worry about the greenhouse effect on Earth always have in the back of their minds. Earth, I won't say much about since you're familiar with it. I'll just mention that Earth orbits the sun at 146 million kilometers. Rather than keep talking about kilometers, I'll follow the astronomical convention and call that distance the astronomical unit, and everything I talk about will be measured in terms of the Earth-Sun distance. Mars is much colder than the Earth. At the warmest places on Mars in the equator, in midsummer, it gets up to about 27 degrees, so it's quite balmy, but the average temperature over the surface of the planet is about minus 55. What's even less pleasant is that its atmosphere is far thinner than the Earth's, only about 1% of the pressure on Earth, so it's quite uninhabitable. Mars also does not have plate tectonics. It does have evidence for erosion, rivers, dry lakes. The most likely fluid that caused that erosion is water, although we're not sure, but there's very little, if any, surface water on Mars at the present time. Jupiter is the first and largest of the gas giant planets. It's called a gas giant because it doesn't have a solid surface. This is just the edge of the atmosphere. Composition is mostly hydrogen and helium because those are the basic elements out of which the planet's formed, and in contrast to the smaller planets, the gravity in these planets is big enough to retain the hydrogen and helium. This shows two of Jupiter's satellites, Io, which is a nice sort of bright reddish color because it has an enormous number of volcanoes that are constantly spewing out lava on the surface, and Europa. This object is the Great Red Spot. The bands that you see here are due to extremely high winds, about 600 kilometers per hour, And the Great Red Spot is some sort of basically Jovian hurricane, which has been seen for at least 300 years. So it's a very long-lived storm to be living through. Further out is Saturn. Major feature of Saturn are this beautiful ring system. The best pictures we have of Saturn so far come from the Voyager spacecraft, which went past in 1980, but we're in for dramatic discoveries starting this summer, because the Cassini spacecraft, which really is enormous, because you see a human down here, has been on its way to Saturn. This picture was taken by Cassini as it approached Saturn, and in about a month, Cassini will fire its motors to go from a passing orbit to inject itself into a Saturn orbit, from where it will spend the next 4 years taking images of Saturn and launching a probe into the atmosphere of one of Saturn's satellites. The rings look solid, but they're not. They're composed of huge numbers of very small particles, perhaps a few centimeters or a few meters across. The rings are one of the thinnest objects we know of in the universe. The diameter of the rings is about 200,000 kilometers, and the thickness is only a few meters. A remarkable system. Uranus is the next planet out. It looks sort of boring. That's because there's a haze of methane and photochemical smog covering the surface. So we know less about Uranus. This, again, is a Voyager picture from 1986. Next is Neptune, a picture from 1989 from the same Voyager spacecraft. Some sort of storm similar to the Great Red Spot. The winds on Neptune are the strongest we know of in the solar system, reaching up to 2,000 kilometers per hour. And the last planet, Pluto, with its satellite, Charon. If I can just go back to, let me just go back for a second. I should point out that the picture that Copernicus drew of the solar system did not include Uranus, Neptune, or Pluto. Uranus was only discovered in the 19th century. Neptune was only discovered as a result of one of the real triumphs of Newton's laws. When people applied Newton's laws to try to follow the orbit of Uranus, they found small, unexplained errors. Rather than reflecting a breakdown in Newton's laws, it turned out that those were due to an extra planet, and mathematicians were able to analyze those errors using Newton's laws, predict the position of the planet that must be necessary to explain them, and when the observers turned their telescopes on it, they found Neptune. The discovery of Pluto is somewhat less of a theoretical triumph. People thought there were still unexplained problems with Neptune's orbit. They did similar calculations. They computed where the extra planet had to be, and in the 1930s, at Lowell Observatory in Arizona, they began searching for this planet. They'd only searched for a couple of months when they found Pluto, but after they found it and measured its mass, they found that its mass was far too small to explain the problems with Neptune's orbit, and the people who had said there were problems with Neptune's orbit were just wrong. So it was only discovered by coincidence. And there are lots of small bodies, asteroids. This is a picture of the asteroid Eros taken from a spacecraft orbiting about 200 kilometers above its surface. This is about 35 kilometers in this direction and maybe 15 or 20 in this direction. The reason it's sort of potato-shaped rather than spherical is because it's so small that its gravity is not able to overcome the strength of its rocks. So this is really just a big rock rather than a planet. And of course, comets. This is a famous picture taken by the European Giotto spacecraft of the nucleus of Halley's Comet. It's a chunk of ice and rock about 10 kilometers across. You can sort of vaguely see its shape and see these jets of what are basically steam and water vapor blowing off as the comet approaches the sun. Those jets produce long tails. This is Comet Hale-Bopp, a different comet from this one, but a tail produced by a similar mechanism. Hale-Bopp, in fact, has two tails. This is dust and small particles, and this is gas. And Hale-Bopp presumably has a similar nucleus, which is very much smaller than the scale of this image, buried in the coma associated with the tail. Okay, so we're trying to understand the gravitational n-body problem. Many famous mathematicians have tried to solve it analytically and have only had limited success. That means that if you're really interested in what's going to happen to the solar system, your only option is to put the equations of motion on a computer and try to just solve the equations numerically with a computer. That's only become possible in the last few years because the speed of computers has continued to increase rapidly. Nevertheless, it's still an extremely difficult problem. And I'm not going to try to give you a lecture on the applied mathematics of trying to solve Newton's equations, but I just want to give you a little bit of the flavor of the problem. The first and most basic problem, of course, is that if you're going to do anything a billion times over, like calculate an orbit, you really have to do it accurately to avoid the buildup of small numerical errors. And so you have to design your software very carefully to avoid any sort of random or systematic buildup of errors. Second problem is that much of the growth in computing capacity recently has been through what's called parallelization, which basically involves taking a problem and splitting it up so that instead of doing it on one computer, you can do it on 10 or 100 or 1,000 computers, different parts of the problem on different computers at the same time, and then combine them once the different parts of the problem are solved. The difficulty, of course, is that you can't do that with a solar system. You can't tell one computer, well, you calculate the orbit of the Earth between 1 million years and 2 million years because you don't know where to start until you've figured out what it did between 0 and 1 million years. That is, the problem is sequential. You can't divide it up into parallel, and so you can never use more than one computer. And so you're limited by the fastest single computer you could buy. The good news is that parallelized computers are very expensive. This problem, because you can only use one, you may as well go out and buy a fast PC with the fastest chip you can, and then just run it on that, you know, spend a few $1,000s on that and run it on that for 6 months and not do anything else with it. So it's not costly in the hardware, but you have to be very patient. One of the specific problems that I'll just describe in a little more detail, because it's a problem that should be familiar to everybody, is trying to avoid round-off error. Now, I'm sure you were all taught about round-off error when you learned arithmetic. It's not terribly important, you know, if you're adding up your grocery bill or trying to calculate your income tax. But as you can imagine, if you're doing a problem over and over again billions of times, you want to be careful that you're not errors that you make from rounding off don't build up. And there are actually two famous real-world examples of why you don't want round-off error to build up. The first comes from the Vancouver Stock Exchange, where in 1982 they invented a new stock index. And you know, as you do with stock indices, you initialize it at 1,000. And what they discovered is that after almost 2 years, the stock index was around 500, but you know, funny thing, everybody seemed to have been making lots of money, and the stock prices had all been going up. So they looked into the software, and it turned out that whoever wrote it, whenever there was a trade, he rounded the price of the stock down. And after you know, the stocks had been traded enough, the index sank. The second problem, which was more serious, was in the 1991 Gulf War. Patriot missile defense systems used a clock step of 1/10 of a second, and they converted that from a binary number, which is the way the computers store the times, into a decimal of 0.1 seconds. They had 22 bits, 22 locations in the binary number. But when the Patriots were designed, they were never designed to be turned on for a very long period. After 100 hours, the accumulated round-off error in doing this calculation over and over again amounted to 1/3 of a second, and at 1/3 of a second, the Patriot failed. It failed to intercept a Scud, and 28 people were killed. And obviously, this is the sort of problem that would have been easy to fix if you'd thought about it, and it arose simply because you were doing a good calculation but making the same mistake over and over and over again millions of times. So how do you handle round-off error in these long and very difficult calculations? Well, round-off error is sort of like a chronic disease. You can never cure it. All you can do is try to minimize the effects. So one is you always use the highest possible precision. In most computers, that's about 16 or 17 decimal digits. You'd like to have more, but that's about all you can do. Another one is that you should never use any number that's not what's called representable in the computer. So the way computers store numbers, you know, if you have a 1 or a 2 or 10,000, they really do store it exactly. If you have a half or a quarter, they store it exactly. But a number like a third, they approximate by the nearest number that they can store. And if you have something in your software that has a 1/3 in it, then every time it gets used over and over again, it's always systematically wrong in exactly the same way, and that causes you big problems. Modern computers, you might think that all computers do arithmetic exactly the same way. That's actually not true. And there was a standard that was propagated by the computer industry to try to make computers do, all computers do arithmetic in the best possible way to minimize these problems. Let me just give you an example of the sorts of ways you can minimize the problems. Suppose you're trying to round off some number and you know, the last digit is somewhere between 0 and 9 and you have to round it off. Well, it's perfectly clear that if you have a 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, you round it down to 0. And if you have a 6, 7, 8, or 9, you round it up to 1. But the question is, what do you do with the 5? Now, when I took arithmetic at Thornhill Public School, Mrs. McBride told me that you should always round it up. And I just want to check, if you were taught to round your 5s up, could you raise your hand? Okay, and how many people were taught to do something other than round your 5s up? Okay, well, you're the ones who were taught right. It's wrong to round 5s up. And the reason is that if you think about it, the numbers you're rounding down are 1, 2, 3, 4. The numbers you're rounding up are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That means you round up 5 times for every 4 times you round down. And that gives you a systematic error. And the right way to do it, just so you'll know for the future, which I assume is the way everybody else was taught, is that you sometimes round 5s up, you sometimes round them down, and the way you pick is just to round so that the digit that's the last digit that you keep is always even. And that just sort of gives you a kind of random up and down that evens out the systematic errors. And modern computers are supposed to always do exactly that with their rounding. If you aren't really sure, if you want to check, there's a program with the wonderful name of Paranoia that's available on the web at that web address, and you can run it on your computer, and it will tell you everything that's wrong with your with the way your computer does arithmetic. Okay, well, let's assume that we now know how to solve the problem. The interesting question is, what's the answer? Well, I'm pleased to say that after 5 billion years, the Earth is still there. That's the punchline of the talk, and you can go home. If you want. All the planets are still there, and all their orbits look pretty much the way they do now. So this is an example, and what they've done here is just taken an interval of 50 million years. The innermost 4 planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, they've just plotted 1,000 or so points taken randomly from this period. And the points sort of map out basically where the orbit is and how far it deviates from circular. And this is what it looks like over the nearest 55 million years. This is what it looks like over the next 55 million years. That's the last 55 million years. This is a similar interval, 4.5 billion years in the future and 4.5 billion years in the past. Remember, they just picked this because that's the age of the solar system. And you can see there are some minor differences, but basically, you know, all 4 planets are still there. And the orbits still look pretty much the same. Nevertheless, this is not a boring problem. There really are a lot of interesting features in what goes on in this system. And let me mention a couple of the interesting features. The first has to do with Pluto, which you remember is the most distant planet. It also has by far the most unusual orbit. Whereas most of the orbits of the planets are pretty much circular, Pluto has an extremely elliptical orbit. Its eccentricity, which would be 0 if it were circular, is around 25%. It also has the highest inclination of any planet. Its orbit is tipped at 17 degrees compared to the plane formed by all the other planets. What's most curious about its orbit is that its closest approach to the sun, because it's so elliptical, is only 29.6 astronomical units, whereas Neptune's on a circular orbit of 30.1 astronomical units. So if Pluto is crossing Neptune's orbit all the time, the natural question is, if it's done this 100 million times, why haven't they collided? Why haven't they hit? And the answer only really became clear once we were able to do these long calculations of the orbits. And the answer is really remarkably elegant. The orbital period of Pluto, the time it takes to go once around the sun, is 247.7 years. The orbital period of Neptune is 164.8 years. If you divide one by the other, you get 1.5 to three significant figures, which is almost exactly 3/2. And that gives you a clue that there's some sort of funny resonance going on between the two planets. And that clue was verified. It turns out that the two planets are exactly in this resonance. That is, no matter how many more digits I would put on this these two orbital periods, I'd get 1.500000. The physical nature of the resonance is easiest to see by imagining that you're sitting on Neptune. So this is a frame that's kind of rotating around the sun with Neptune. And you can see that in that frame, the orbit of Pluto takes this funny rosette shape. So there's Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus. They still look circular. But Pluto has this funny rosette. And you can see that whenever Pluto is closest to the sun, it's always pretty close to 90 degrees away from Neptune. Maybe gets as close as 60 degrees. But this resonance arranges the orbit so that Pluto only crosses Neptune's orbit when it's a long way away from Neptune. So they never collide. You can calculate these orbits as far as you want in the future and the past. And even though the orbits cross, they'll never collide. Well, this is really a beautiful result. And the next obvious question is, how did this happen? Why should the formation of the solar system have arranged for this for Pluto to show up in this strange orbit? And the explanation, which is, again, almost equally elegant, came from Renu Malhotra about 10 years ago. She pointed out that very early in the history of the solar system, there was plenty of debris left over between the planets, the material that hadn't yet been incorporated in the planets. This debris would gravitationally interact with Neptune, and Neptune would tend to eject it from the solar system. And in the process of doing so, the back reaction would cause Neptune's orbit to slowly drift outwards. Now, if you imagine that Pluto started off in a circular orbit, like all the other planets did, outside Neptune, as Neptune drifts out, it would eventually cross this, Neptune's orbital period would increase, and eventually there'd come a point when Pluto's orbital period was just 1.500000 times the orbital period of Neptune. At that point, it turns out, if you follow what happens using Newton's laws, Pluto gets captured into the resonance. And from thereafter, even as Neptune continues to move out, it stays exactly in that 3-2 ratio. However, as Neptune moves out, although it stays in that 3-2 ratio, the orbit starts to change. It becomes less circular and more eccentric, and it starts to build up an inclination. And in fact, all of the funny features of Pluto's orbits, the high eccentricity, the high inclination, and the fact that it's exactly in this resonance, are a natural consequence of the single hypothesis that Neptune drifted out and captured Pluto from a circular orbit. Moreover, this hypothesis makes a prediction. Since Pluto wasn't necessarily the only object out there, other objects might be captured in this resonance as well, so Pluto might not be alone. And that prediction, it turns out, has been verified. This is a snapshot, as of October 20th of last year, of the positions of all the small bodies, asteroids, comets, and other bodies known in the solar system, that is, the small bodies outside the planets. The blue objects are comets, which you only see when they're very close to the sun. This is the orbit of Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, Jupiter. The Earth's orbit is too small to see on this. And most of these red and white objects are objects called Kuiper belt objects. They're in an extended belt, somewhat like the asteroid belt, of small bodies that orbits outside Neptune. These were mostly discovered in the last decade. There are now roughly 1,000 known. And as people discovered more and more of them and started to calculate their orbits and work out exactly what their orbits were like, they discovered a remarkable thing, which is that a very large fraction of them are exactly in the same 3-2 resonance that Pluto is in. So the ones in this resonance have started to be called Plutinos, for little Plutos. And almost certainly what happened is that these were smaller bodies than Pluto, that like Pluto were captured in the resonance when Neptune migrated outwards. And that the fact that Pluto's orbit shares this property with so many of these small bodies is one of the reasons that most astronomers nowadays don't think of Pluto as a planet. They think of it as just the largest member of this vast Kuiper belt of small bodies outside Neptune. But there are more interesting things about the behavior of the solar system on very long times. One of the things we've learned from studying this problem and many other dynamical systems is that, roughly speaking, you can divide dynamical systems into two kinds. What are called regular dynamical systems, which are highly predictable and well-behaved. And mathematically, what that says is if you take the system and you change it a little bit and follow the new system and the old system, the difference between them will grow, but it'll only grow linearly with the time. So if you, say, throw a baseball, and then you imagine throwing another baseball from a position a millimeter different, after 1 second, the difference might be 2 millimeters, after 2 seconds, it might be 3, after 3 seconds, it might be 4, and so forth. The difference grows slowly. In contrast to this, there are chaotic systems, which are difficult to predict and erratic. In those cases, small differences grow exponentially. So that means the difference is a millimeter after 1 second, after 2 seconds, it's 2 millimeters, for 3 seconds, it might be 4, then 8, then 16. The difference blows up. And there are many examples. So for example, a typical chaotic system would be a roulette wheel. And that's because the roulette wheel is designed to make the motion of the ball as unpredictable as possible. Dice or pinball are other examples. More important example is the weather. The reason that weather predictions only work well over the space of a few days is because the system, the atmospheric system, is basically chaotic. Regular systems, the whole idea of golf is that the motion of the golf ball is very regular and therefore predictable. If you have a very rough green, that makes the motion chaotic and sort of destroys all the fun of golf. The importance of chaotic systems wasn't recognized really until computers came along, because it turns out that the only problems that you can write down the answer to with a pencil and paper are regular problems. So all of the problems that you ever did in a physics course are regular systems. And I have a little demonstration, which I hope some of you can see, of the difference between a regular and a chaotic system. This is just a very simple pendulum. Pendulums are extremely regular. That's why they were the basis of clock mechanisms for hundreds of years. If you start this, it just goes back and forth, completely predictable. You know exactly what the period is. You know exactly what it's going to do until it gradually damps out from friction in the bearing. But you can modify this. And the modification is simply to make it into a double pendulum. So what I've got is the first pendulum here, a second one here with a second hub. And if I start it near the bottom and I just let it go back and forth, you can see it behaves pretty much like a single pendulum. That is, it's still regular, it's still predictable, it's not doing anything very interesting. But if you start it up, say, up here, you get a somewhat different behavior. And you can see that just adding this one extra complication to the... to the mechanical system makes the behavior completely different. And this is the sort of prototypical chaotic system. Okay, it really is. I'll start it again while I keep talking. It's really difficult to resume. Okay, well, of course, the whole success of Newton's laws in explaining the motion of the solar system arises from the fact but on relatively short time scales, tens of years or hundreds of years or tens of thousands of years, the solar system is completely regular and extremely well behaved. However, when people started to do these very long calculations of the planets, they got a surprise. They were doing the classic test to see whether a system is regular or chaotic. But as they started all the planets off, and then they started off a slightly different system. So for instance, here, this is the distance between Jupiter in the first calculation and a second calculation in which they kept everything except the same, except they moved the position of Jupiter by 1 millimeter out of 300 million kilometers. And what happened is that over very long times, over a few hundred million years, the difference started to grow exponentially. So this is a graph in which this distance is a factor of 1,000, and you can see that about every 100 million years, the difference between the two grows by about a factor of 1,000. It stops out here, and that's simply because after this amount of time, the original Jupiter and the second one that you started are on opposite sides of the solar system. They can't get any further apart. So the difference between them grew from 1 millimeter to several hundred million kilometers over 300 million years. The same thing is true for Pluto. Here you can see it's the difference between Pluto and a fake Pluto in two different tests growing by a factor of 10,000 about every 100 million years. When you look at this for the planets, you find that every planet in the solar system is chaotic, including the Earth. The chaos is sufficiently strong that the separation of an original planet and a second planet will tend to double on a time scale of about 10 million years. So what are the consequences of this? All the orbits of the planets are chaotic. That doesn't mean that the planets are all wandering all over the solar system. It turns out the chaos is, they're limited to relatively small rings around their current orbits. So the orbits, that's why the orbits look the same in that picture I showed you earlier. Nevertheless, it means that small changes in the positions of the planets are amplified by a factor that's 10 with 150 zeros after it over the lifetime of the solar system. So for example, what that means is that if NASA launches an interplanetary spacecraft in one direction next week, the back reaction on that changes the orbit of the Earth a little bit. And that change will gradually grow enough so that after 100 million years, the Earth will be on the opposite side of the sun from where it would have been before the spacecraft was launched. What it also means that if you follow the planets for a very long time, you do eventually start to see some changes in the orbits. This is the longest calculation that's been done. The time here is measured in billions of years. It's kind of a fake calculation because, as I said, the sun will turn into a red giant here, but of course you can do the calculation ignoring the death of the sun and just keep going. And what you see is that the eccentricity of Mercury's orbit basically undergoes a sort of random walk. It looks kind of like the stock market over a very long period of 10 to 15 billion years. The Earth, on the other hand, doesn't seem to vary very much. Mars is somewhat intermediate. What are the consequences of that? Well, if Mercury is wandering all over the place like that, eventually Mercury is going to collide with one of the other planets or fall into the sun or get ejected from the solar system. So that means that, in a certain sense, the solar system really is unstable. If you wait long enough, one of the planets, probably Mercury, is likely to get ejected. So the mathematical question of whether the solar system is stable, the answer is no. The practical question, is the Earth still going to be here when the sun dies? The answer is probably yes. It also, one of the ironies of this, of course, is that the solar system was the inspiration for Laplacian determinism. It's the model that's always held up as a deterministic universe, and in fact, it turns out to be unpredictable on very long timescales. But there are other interesting consequences as well. If Mercury is likely to be ejected sometime in the future, what's to say that that hasn't already happened in the past? What's to say that we didn't start out with 10 or 15 planets and several of them have been ejected in the past? Obviously, we can't tell. Planets are gone, and we have no way of knowing whether they were there or not. But there is a really significant clue that this might have happened. This plot is a little bit complicated, but the concept is easy to explain. In this particular case, instead of just calculating the motion of all of the planets, what Matt Holman did was he added a whole bunch of small particles in between the planets. He added about 5,000 small particles spread out between Jupiter, which is at a radius here, and Neptune at a radius here. And then he just followed what happened to them along with the planets. And the green dots represent the point at which one of these small particles got ejected. So for instance, this particle got ejected after 1 million years, this one after 100 million years, this one here after about 1 billion years. And the red ones mark the particles that survived until the age of the solar system at about 5 billion years. And you can see that practically none of the particles survived. These are actually particles on the same orbit as Jupiter, but leading or lagging it by 60 degrees. We know that particles there should survive because a set of a family of asteroids called the Trojan asteroids are there. But all of the small bodies in between the planets didn't survive. The ones out here survived, and that's good because that's where we see the objects in the Kuiper belt, so it's a good thing that those orbits are stable. What that says is if there was ever a planet anywhere between Jupiter and Neptune, it would have gotten kicked out of the solar system long before the current time. What that means, in a sense, is this region of the giant planets is full. Even if you wanted to stuff another planet in there, you couldn't do that. And the most natural reason to suspect that it's full is that it once had more planets, and some of the planets, like some of these small bodies, got ejected when the solar system was much younger. Okay, so let me just recapitulate. These are some of the questions that I asked right at the start, and we can now give some but not all of the answers. What's the fate of the Earth? As far as we know, the Earth will survive 7 billion years until the sun dies and turns into a red giant. Whether it will swallow the Earth or not is a little harder to say. Most likely the Earth will survive, but Mercury and Venus will not. Why are there so few planets? Basically because the solar system is full. We couldn't put any more in, even if we wanted to. Why are the regions between the planets so clean? That's the same reason. You don't see small bodies between Earth and Venus or between Jupiter and Saturn because they couldn't survive. The only region where they can survive is the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter and the Kuiper belt outside Neptune. Was the present state of the solar system determined in its first million years? We don't know, but the answer is probably not. People who focus on the formation of the solar system are trying to solve an important problem, but there's almost certainly a second, much slower evolutionary stage that's determined many of the properties of the current system. Can we calibrate the geological timescale over the last 100 million years? The answer is yes. We can't do it much further than that because this chaotic nature of the solar system starts to affect the accuracy of the calculation. But astronomers are now providing the geologists with extremely accurate models of the variations of the amount of sunlight on the Earth over the last 100 million years. The final and perhaps most interesting question is, what will other planetary systems look like? I don't have a theoretical answer for that, but what I will do in the last few minutes of the talk is tell you what the current observational status is of other planetary systems. For hundreds of years, astronomers have been looking for planetary systems around other stars, but it's an extremely difficult problem. The problem is not that the planets are so faint, it's that the stars are so bright. The problem is not that you could see the planets if they were isolated, but they're overwhelmed by the light of the star. The analogy that's sometimes drawn is like trying to looking at a searchlight with a big telescope from 10 miles away and trying to find a firefly flying around the searchlight. So you have to use indirect methods. And by far the most successful of these has been the recognition that if you have an unseen planet orbiting a star, both the planet and the star, the planet doesn't just orbit around the star, but both the star and the planet orbit around their common center of gravity. And that means that as the planet orbits, the star comes towards you and then away from you at speeds of maybe 100 kilometers per hour. The Doppler shift, the same shift that causes the sound of a train coming towards you to be different from a train going away, shifts the spectrum of the star. And those shifts can be detected with very accurate measurements. This technique was actually pioneered by Gordon Walker at the University of British Columbia, who had a long program to monitor a dozen nearby stars to look for planets. It turned out that he was unlucky. He picked the wrong stars. And the first group who were lucky were a group centered at the University of Geneva. And they found a star whose velocity towards us varied like this. That's an unmistakable signature of a planet with a period of a little over 4 days on a nearly circular orbit, with a mass that's just under Jupiter's mass. By now, we know of over 100 planets. This is a diagram that used to make a lot more sense when there were fewer planets, but now it's squashed so much you can hardly read it. But basically, they've ranked the planets in terms of distance from their parent star. There's one astronomical unit, so the Earth would be about here. There are a few cases where there are multiple planets, where they see more than one planet in a given system. All of the planet masses are typically a few Jupiter masses, and maybe occasionally as small as a Saturn mass. That's simply because current techniques aren't sensitive enough to detect planets that are any smaller, not because there's any reason to suppose that they're not there. Since these are detected by an indirect method, just by looking at changes in the star, of course you don't know for sure that they're planets, and there was a tremendous amount of skepticism that these might be due to some funny effect in the atmosphere of the star, or some mistake that people were making in the analysis. So it's extremely important to have some kind of confirmation. One possible way of confirmation is to recognize that although these planetary orbits are going to be oriented at random, if you have enough stars, there's likely to be a small fraction of them where the planetary orbit is exactly edge-on. And that means that once per orbit, the planet will pass directly in front of the star. When it passes directly in front of the star, it'll block out some of the starlight and yield to a very small but perhaps detectable periodic dip in the light from the star. This is a phenomenon that actually also occurs in the solar system, most prominently as the transit of Venus. This is a relatively rare event in our solar system. No one living has seen this event because the last one occurred in 1882, but I'm pleased to report that the next one is next Tuesday. This is an image from the 1882 event. These were extremely important historically, and in fact, Captain Cook's voyage of discovery to the South Seas, in which he discovered Tahiti, was motivated by the fact that there was a transit of Venus that was observable from the South Pacific, and it was used in the 18th and 19th century to try to measure actually the size of the astronomical unit. By now, it's more of a curiosity than anything else. This particular transit, the entire transit, is visible from Europe. It's not visible from the West Coast. It's only marginally visible from here, from Waterloo. It's only visible from after the sun rises until about 7:25 next Tuesday morning. I would caution you that if you want to go look for this, you don't look at the sun directly because you can cause permanent damage to your eyes. The safest way is to use a pinhole camera, just to put a small hole in a piece of paper and hold it up in front of a flat screen. But if you just look for, you know, if you just Google transit of Venus, you'll find lots of advice on how to look for it if the skies are clear on Tuesday morning. Well, to go back to other planetary systems, people went out, once they recognized the possibility of a transit, they went out and looked with 100 stars with known planets around them. The chances were that one or maybe two might show a transit, and we were lucky, and one of them did. You can see this is one example of the transit caused by the planet in this particular system. The light from the star drops by about 1.5%. The shape of this curve is enormously informative. I'm telling you about properties of the planets. In this case, we know more about this. Because of that, we know more about this than any other extrasolar planet. The mass is just under 70% of a Jupiter mass. The radius is somewhat bigger than Jupiter's, and that's simply because it's so close to the parent star. Its orbital radius is only a 20th of an astronomical unit, far closer than Mercury is to the sun. The planet is going to be heated up. It's heated up and it expands. And so this 1.35 Jupiter radii is just about what you would expect. And there's even evidence that they've detected absorption line in the planetary atmosphere, which suggests that it's a gas giant planet like Jupiter. You can always do measurements of transits better from space than from the ground for two reasons. You don't have to worry about fluctuations in the brightness of the star due to the atmosphere, and you can watch the star 24/7 without worrying about clouds or daytime. The European Space Agency and NASA are therefore launching an armada of satellites that will do nothing but look at transits around nearby stars, look for transits around nearby stars. But actually the first satellite to do this is a Canadian satellite called MOST, which was designed mostly for other purposes, launched last summer, and has a limited capability to look for transits, and is now monitoring transits around several stars, in particular the one that I just showed you. They haven't released any results yet. We're all eagerly waiting to see what the results will be, and they ought to be released sometime in the next few weeks. A third method to look for planets is astrometry. It's kind of the complement of looking at velocities. In this case, as the planet and the star move around their mutual center of gravity, you see a little bit of wobble in the position of the star. This is what the wobble of the sun would look like if we were looking at it from 30 light years away. The challenge here is that the wobble is very small. This distance is a thousandth of a second of arc. That's about the distance subtended by my thumb if I were standing in Vancouver and you were looking at it from here. That's actually not so bad. Astronomers can do that from space. The problem is that you have to get much better than that to see to do an accurate measurement of the planet. A mission planned by NASA for launch in 2009 called the Space Interferometry Mission is aiming for a microarc second. That's a factor of 1,000 better, and it's going to be a real technical challenge to see if they can do it. Finally, the most exotic method of detecting planets is a method called gravitational lensing. If a star passes between, if an intervening body of any kind passes between a distant star and the Earth, according to Einstein, it bends the light of the star. That bending of the light means that this intervening body acts sort of like a lens. It means that temporarily, when that body's lined up just right, it'll make the star brighten in a very predictable way. The trouble is that you have to be very accurately aligned to be an effective lens. That means you have to monitor a large number of stars and just hope that every now and then one of them will show this brightening. And that has now been done. This is an example of a gravitational lensing event caused by an intervening star, not a planet. You can see that the brightness of the star increased by a large factor during this event, which lasted several years, and can be fit extremely well by simple theoretical models. Because the light curve from the star can be fit so well by this very simple model, if this star has a planet around it, what you expect to see is some sort of bump or deviation from this simple curve when the planet itself acts like an even smaller lens. People have been searching for this for several years, and just a few weeks ago they announced the first secure event. This is somewhat noisier, and you can see how tough the problem is. There's what the star looks like before it brightens, and there's what it looks like at the peak of the brightness. And of course the technical challenge is separating this from all the stuff around it. But you can see that this straightforward light curve has two spikes on it, in particular this very sharp spike here. Modeling that tells you that this planet has a planet, this star has a planet of about a Jupiter mass around it, orbiting at about 3 astronomical units from the star. So this is the first detection of a planet by microlensing. It's by far the most distant planet known. It's about halfway to the center of the galaxy. And with larger and larger detectors and more programs, we're going to be discovering a lot more planets that way. Okay, well, let me summarize. What we've learned is that planet formation is common. 10 years ago, if you'd said only one star in a million had planets, you might very well have been correct. We now know that at least 10% of nearby stars host giant planets. However, these planetary systems are very different from our own. In our system, we have terrestrial planets like the Earth close by, and giant planets out at much larger distances. In these systems, the giant planets are something like 100 times closer to the sun, to their star, than Jupiter is to the sun. What we don't know is why they're so different from our solar system. Is our solar system the exception or the rule? We don't know whether you can have Earth mass planets in these systems. We don't know how common Earth mass planets are in general. We know of no Earth mass planets outside our own solar system. And of course, what we'd really like to know is how common are habitable planets, and we have no information on that either. So to close, I wanted to close by trying to summarize our current the current status of our understanding of planets. The best I can do is a sort of analogy, which is to imagine that Darwin was trying to write his theory of evolution, but all he had observational data on were primates, monkeys, and man. You know, he might still, being a clever guy, have come up with a theory of evolution. He might understand that primates and men descended from a common ancestor. And he probably would have gotten the basic ideas correct. But he never would have been able to imagine the tremendous rich diversity that there are in living organisms. He would never have been able, you know, even if he understood evolution, he would never have been able to invent the idea of a whale or a butterfly or an alligator. And I think right now planetary scientists and astronomers are in somewhat the same position. We understand a lot about planets. We understand a lot about how the planets in our own solar system were formed. But my hope would be that over the coming years and decades, we'll discover a richness in other planetary systems that's comparable to the richness that you see in biological species on the Earth. Thank you.
At this point, we'll take questions from the audience. We have two people with microphones going up and down the aisle, so please just put up your hand and you will be seen to shortly. So, there's one person over there.
Does the research that this is leading to provide better information on interception paths between things like asteroids and things like planets?
Not directly. Obviously, you know, one of the concerns, you know, if you like to worry about things on a timescale longer than your mortgage, sort of intermediate to worrying about whether the Earth's going to be around in 5 billion years and worrying about your mortgage is whether there's going to be a catastrophic impact 100 million years from now that wipes out civilization. This information does not help us, you know, searching for such objects is very important, but this kind of research doesn't really help with that because on the scales we're talking about here, you know, figuring out whether an asteroid is going to collide with the Earth in 100 or a couple of 100 years or next week is in the sort of short-term regime where Newton's equations give very predictable, very well-behaved answers, and it's easy to, you know, the problem there is not calculating the future course of the asteroid and whether it's going to hit. The problem is doing a large enough observational survey that's accurate enough and reaches objects faint enough to be able to detect all of the potentially hazardous objects.
To the person over there in the green shirt.
I was wondering about Bode's law. It's compelling because it's a fairly simple empirical succession of planetary radii. Has your model been calculations show that the configuration of the solar system looks pretty steady over periods of billions of years, and you would think that this would show that Bode's law shows an underlying system of resonances or stable resonances. Yet, it looks like you have a whole variety of systems out there. Do you have any comment on that, whether Bode's law might be a natural progression of planetary positions.
Sure. Let me give a little bit of the background. Bode's law is an empirical law that describes the positions of the planets as a geometric progression. It was invented by Bode back, I think, in the 18th or 17th century, and it had two great successes. He invented the law before the discovery of Uranus, and the position of Uranus fit extremely well into the prediction of Bode's law. It also predicted that there was a missing planet between Mars and Jupiter, and his predicted position for the missing planet turned out to be very close to the position of the largest asteroid. So those two successes gave Bode's law a great deal of credibility. However, it does have some problems. I mean, the first problem is that asteroids really aren't planets. They're a lot smaller. The second is that it failed badly to predict the location of Neptune. And if you look in detail at the law, he had to kind of cheat to get Mercury to fit in. So, you know, you've got eight planets and three exceptions. And so it probably shouldn't be taken too seriously. What it probably does say is that you can't, if you're trying to build a solar system, you can't just sort of dump the planets down in random locations because it's likely to be unstable. The most stable systems are likely to be ones in which the planets are somewhat regularly spaced. And if you put in some sort of approximate regular spacing and you try a bunch of different laws, you're likely to find one that works as well as Bode's law.
The gentleman with the gray t-shirt standing up.
You didn't mention anything about Saturn and its rings, and if it's stable, if the rings are stable, or if they're in the progress, or if they're in progress of changing into something different, or how it became the only planet in our solar system that has rings.
Well, of course, one reason is that the results from Cassini are going to revolutionize everything we understand about the rings over the next two or three years. So I didn't want to say anything wrong, but. I think that's a very interesting question and a very difficult question. The basic issue is how long-lived are the rings? Has Saturn always had this beautiful ring system, or is it something that was formed relatively recently and doesn't last for very long? Traditionally, astronomers have always believed that the ring system was permanent and had just been there and was some sort of relic of the formation process of Saturn. But the results that came back from Voyager indicated that the dynamical processes within the rings and the interactions between the rings and the satellites were suggesting that the configuration of the rings would change on timescales of maybe 10 to 100 million years. If that's true, it's likely that the rings are rather short-lived. They may have formed because a passing body, a Kuiper Belt object, passed so close to Saturn that it was tidally disrupted. The tidally disrupted pieces ground one another down to form the rings. But at this stage, we really don't know. So it's entirely an open question.
The gentleman standing over there.
I won't say what color my shirt is. Is the fact that the systems that we've discovered have mostly very large planets much closer in than in our solar system due to the fact that that's all we can detect right now? Another way to phrase that is, if our solar system were 100 or 200 million years away, 2 million light years away from us, would we be able to detect it from here?
Right, so that's a very good question. The answer is that yes, the reason that we're only seeing large planets that are close in is because that's all we can detect. The capabilities of the observers are steadily increasing, partly because they're getting better techniques and partly because they've just been watching these things for a longer time. You know, the orbital period of Jupiter is over 10 years, and so you'd have to watch the Earth for 15 years or so before you were convinced that you'd seen the sort of oscillatory motion associated with a planet. We're just now getting to the point where they're starting to report planets that are almost Jupiter's period and almost Jupiter's mass. So if they were looking at the solar system from 100 light years away, you might expect an announcement sometime in the next few years. So they're close, but only just close.
Okay. We have time for two more questions. The individual standing there with the microphone.
Yes, hi. Yes, in your talk, you alluded to Uranus and Neptune sort of migrating further out. And I've heard that in the formation of the solar system, it's likely that Uranus and Neptune formed much later. And I'm wondering if the outward migration could still be going on. And if so, is that going to give more space for the inner planets to also sort of migrate?
The best guess we have is that the migration is not going on anymore. And the reason is simply that the migration, the only thing we know of that would drive the migration is kind of cleaning up the debris left over from formation. That is, gravitational interactions with leftover bodies that were being ejected, and that ejection, the back reaction from that ejection, was driving the planets outward. The only debris that's left over in the solar system that we know of are the asteroids and the Kuiper belt. The masses of those are only somewhere between a millionth and a billionth of the mass of the sun. They're far too small to have any significant effect on the orbits of Uranus and Neptune at this point.
And the last question for the individual at the back of the room.
Would some of the extrasolar planets recently discovered exhibit a noticeable degree of precession? And if so, would you be able to get some information of the force laws that give rise to such precession?
If you're talking about precession of the elliptical orbits of the planets, you can get some information on that. The orbits that we see right now are perfectly well fit by Newton's laws. They look just like the orbits in the solar system. If there were some sort of deviation from Newton's laws, perhaps caused by other planets, those would cause the orbits to precess, that is, the orientation to change. But typically, that change is rather slow. That means that you have to look for many, many orbital periods to detect such precession. And so, you know, it's going to be something that the observers can investigate, but it kind of depends on how patient they are and whether they're really willing to look at these things systematically and steadily for decades to find these small effects.
Great. At this point, I would very much like to thank Professor Tremaine for a very clear, stimulating, and informative lecture. Thanks very much. And before we close, I would like to remind the audience here of several points. First of all, Perimeter Institute's public event series will be taking a break over the summer, and we will resume in September with a stimulating set of lectures and events, and check our website for more details. However, our black hole sessions, of which some of you may not have heard, will continue throughout the summer. They are held on the first Saturday of every month, and they are from 10 o'clock in the morning until noon. Dr. Richard Epp, our educational program coordinator, will be leading those sessions, as he has for some time. This is actually an idea that we stole from Fermilab, and they ran something called Saturday Morning Physics, which was quite successful, but we thought to make it even more successful, we'd call it something other than Saturday Morning Physics. So we call it the Black Hole Sessions, and lo and behold, it's extremely successful here as well. So you're all welcome to that. The other thing I'd like to point out is that our grand public opening will be held on October 2nd of this coming year for our new building, so please come down and enjoy that. And lastly, I'd like to thank the staff and students and everyone involved at Waterloo Collegiate Institute for all of their efforts for enabling us to hold such a successful series of public events here at WCI. So thank you all very much, and good night.